Next up, we have Jim Luby. Jim is at the University of Minnesota, heads the tree fruit and berry breeding meta program, I'll call it, and he is Rosebreed's pom fruit breeding team leader. So the next three talks, Jim and the next two will be covering the general crop groups that we have. A lot of DNA-informed breeding went on in each of these crops, but each of them will talk about a particular aspect of that and a particular germplasm level. So Jim's talking about parents. Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Cameron. In discussing accelerated breeding, Jay already kind of set the stage for talking about using markers in parent selection, and I'll continue along that line as into the way we use it in our breeding program at the University of Minnesota. I'll first give a little overview of apple breeding and the use of DNA information, talk some about the traits, loci, and markers that we use in our program, the process, and a couple of the uses that we have, and then a little bit about looking ahead. So as far as kind of an overview, we have what I would consider a fairly conventional approach to breeding at the University of Minnesota, starting with crossing in year one, germinating seeds, starting them in year two, eventually getting those out to an orchard and growing them up through juvenility and then evaluating them in, I'll say, years 3 to 10. And then those individuals that are selected for further testing are put into clonal trials. This typically goes up to about 15 years after crossing. And then finally, in what we call stage three, the better selections go into grower trials and hopefully to commercialization, the golden ticket, and hopefully resulting in a cultivar, which can take anywhere from 15 to 25 years after crossing, in our experience. To kind of superimpose DNA in the use of DNA information in apple breeding in our program, it comes into play in several places. Parent selection, which I'll be talking about more, of course, through this presentation, as we design our crosses, and then also in seedling selection. Once selections get to the stage two phase, we do a genome scan on all of them for pedigree verification, and then also eventually to facilitate haplotyping for QTL validation and potential parent use. And then finally, as we get into more advanced testing and commercialization, markers are again used quite a bit for identity verification. But it's really this stage two genome scan information that's becoming more and more important in facilitating our marker-assisted parent selection. So what's the financial incentive for using DNA information for parent selection? Well, we grow out these thousands of seedlings each year. It takes us about $40 per seedling to get them through the juvenile phase, evaluate them after fruiting, and then eventually remove the planting. And about 99% of the seedlings end up like this, a bunch of ash and CO2, and only a very few go on. Perhaps about 1 in 15,000 to become a cultivar at a cost of probably over $800,000. Talking a little bit about traits and loci that we look at, in selecting target traits, the really important criteria are that they be traits that are really an important basis for culling in our phenotypic selection. What are we throwing things away for? That's what we're really looking at. And then also traits that really pose evaluation bottlenecks for us. And fruit traits fit into both these criteria very well. They require a long time to evaluate due to juvenility. And then also palate fatigue is a major limiting factor in many fruit breeding programs, including ours. So texture, taste, storageability, and appearance tend to be very important. Disease resistance is also something we emphasize. Jay gave a good introduction to this, and we use some of the same loci that Jay has been talking about as well. So as far as steps, once you've chosen the traits, You want to identify loci that are relevant, and we identify loci that are relevant in our germplasm. Some of this we get from examining the literature. We identify some of the loci ourselves in our germplasm, and then for all of them, we try to confirm that in our segregating families, we actually have segregating phenotypic effects as well. And just put the little graphs to the side. Feature one trait, which is malic acid content, which is the major acid in apples that gives you that tartness. And this is from a paper from Washington State from Sajit Verma and collaborators, and basically outlines with the two big bumps there, the blue bump and the pink bump. I won't go into it in much detail, but there are two major loci that condition malic acid content in apple, one on chromosome 8 and one on chromosome 16. And this leads us to what we do once those loci are identified. In our breeding program then, let's say we're looking at chromosome 16 malic acid locus, which is termed MA. We identify the SNP haplotypes in our program for a locus, and then estimate the effect of each haplotype from segregating families. And so the example here that's given, I've shown three potential breeding parents in our program or ancestors in our program. And then the SNP haplotypes are defined usually by several SNPs. In this case, it's 11, and you can see that these three breeding parents actually feature six unique haplotypes. And then for each of those haplotypes, we try to determine what the phenotypic effect is. And you can see it's generally high or low, and then Honeycrisp has kind of a medium effect at one for one of its haplotypes. So this gives us the information then when these parents are in our breeding program that we can predict the effects using them as parents, hopefully. We also do what my colleague Rex Bernardo calls postdiction, which is validation or examination of these haplotypes in selected material. So since we're a program with a fairly long history, 110 years, we can see what have we selected in the program that we've genotyped, and what was its phenotypic for performance, both for the trait of interest, let's say malic acid content here, and then also for other traits. Would we have gone wrong had we employed this a selection for a particular marker, or use of a particular marker? And so essentially, do trait values correspond with predicted values based on haplotypes at the target loci? And then also, would there be any unintended consequences? And we have seen this at some loci, that if we had selected a certain way, using what was thought to be the favorable allele or the favorable haplotype, we would have gone wrong for some other trait. So that's an important step, too. As far as the loci we use, they're featured, they're highlighted here on the 17 chromosomes of apple. I'm not going to go through each one of them, but as you examine them, you'll see that most of them are indeed for fruit traits, such as fruit texture and fruit storage. And then we've also got, for example, on chromosome 1, scab resistance for two of the loci that Jay talked about in his talk. So these are about 16 or so regions that we talk about, or that we examine in our program rather routinely. As far as the DNA information used, generally two types. We have SSR, indel, or SNP markers at each of those loci that we use. They're fairly simple to run and usually relatively easy to interpret, and usually fairly low in expense, about $2 to $5 per individual per locus. We have, then of course I've mentioned we do genome scans. We use the, now at this point, the 20K array from Illumina. The data curation is more complicated, as well as the interpretation. The expense is about $50. Per individual, but it gives you genome-wide information that you can use for usually all the loci that we have interest in. Also gives information on identity by descent for important haplotypes and potentially important recombination in those regions. As far as a couple examples of how we use this information, in designing crosses, it's really very much the way we've always done it in terms of incorporating phenotype information. It's not that we totally neglect phenotype information. We've also then incorporated all of the genotype information or marker information that we have into a spreadsheet that we can use alongside phenotype information to do our little dating game for the parents. Couple examples. Honeycrisp features prominently in the ancestry of our material now at this point. As we're two or three generations away from it, it's still a lot of its genome is present. It is well known for having susceptibility to chilling injury in storage, and we get some symptoms such as you see here, soft scald and soggy breakdown, as well as some other nasty things too that can happen to fruit in storage. Graduate student Nick Howard did some work and studied and found that this disorder is controlled largely by a locus on chromosome 2, and that the probability goes up as you have, and that Honeycrisp is homozygous for a high disorder allele, and so the probability goes up considerably as you have homozygosity especially. So as we design our crosses, these are all the different possibilities, homozygotes by homozygotes or heterozygotes involved, and we can predict what are the outcomes, and then also whether it would be useful to do any marker-assisted seedling selection. So I've listed, you know, the various options that we consider there. Another one we found is that another use we found is to predict seedling mortality. We started noticing that in some of our crosses we had over 30% mortality, where it's historically been about 10%. Independently, we are studying a leaf disorder in Honeycrisp that traces to chromosome 9 called zonal leaf fluorosis. Honeycrisp is susceptible and exhibits pretty severe symptoms. But we never found homozygous recessive types until we looked in the greenhouse, and those were indeed the seedlings that were dying. And so this told us that when we had parents that carried this recessive, we needed to make sure that we made a lot more seeds to reach our number of desired seedlings for those crosses. Looking ahead, a couple of the lessons learned, probably the two main lessons learned, is that phenotyping is the main limitation for us. This is probably not surprising for anybody who's been involved in these efforts, both quantity and quality of data, and then careful definition of the target traits. And then the amount of time spent on data curation is much greater than we anticipated too. Coming attractions, we hope, will be genomic prediction of parent values, rather than just looking at the points, and then also improved graphical representation, which Cameron and colleagues have been working on. So with that, thank you very much. Oh, yeah, I'll feature our international partners here, too.
Okay, we have time for some questions.
So, Jim, 110 years, classical breeding done most of that time. You and Dave Bedford have been there a few years now, not near 110. What are the key parts to implement this in what is a very established program, with the molecular aspects being a completely additional activity and expense, and getting that all implemented? How have you done it?
Okay, question is, how have we implemented marker-assisted parent selection in a very long-standing program? Basically, we've just, I think as that one slide showed, we use our phenotype information still in much the same way that we've been collecting it at least the last 35 years or so. I can't speak for the folks before that, but and then using the genotype information to give us some additional insight as to what we should expect. And of course, that genotype information is based almost always on information from segregating families that have sort of gone before. And so I don't know if that gets at your question, John. But
yeah, I guess more the keys. Who's doing all that
part? Oh, who's doing the work?
How did you get that built into your system?
Okay, who's doing the work? graduate students are doing much of the phenotyping. It did require basically hiring an additional technical position to do the data management, I would say. Yep. Well, in the commercial vent, okay, so who does the actual genotyping, which is part of implementing it? We do have commercial vendors, and we also use our in-house, well, we do some in our lab, especially discovery stuff. We do some at our core facility, and then for larger scale, we use commercial vendors.
Thank you. All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Jeff.